You're listening to High Control, a podcast about identifying, leaving, and recovering from high control, high demand groups, also known as cults. We're not experts, but we do know what it's like to be a part of and then leave a cult. Your high control journey starts now.
Welcome to the High Control Podcast. My name is Scott Lloyd, along with my friend, Allie Henney. And the High Control Podcast is a program that is designed to share our personal stories of being in high control groups and cults, and also to inspire and encourage others who might want to consider whether or not they're being influenced by a cult and help them find the courage to walk away. So, Allie, good to see you again, my friend.
Yeah, well, it's good to be back here on the mic with you, Scott. You're leading, you're hosting this episode, and so I can't wait to see what you have in store for us.
Well, it's my pleasure. And last time we were together, we talked about and attempted to answer the question, was I in a cult? And what you and I came to discover is that we had very different experiences, but shared a lot of similarities with the groups that we were involved in. And I came to the conclusion that indeed I was in a cult growing up in the United Pentecostal Church. But your answer was a little bit more nuanced. And I think what we discovered together was that these high control groups are on a spectrum of sorts. At one end, you have the deadly cults that you hear about a lot in the news that get a lot of attention. But on that spectrum are a myriad of high control groups that influence people in negative ways throughout their lives. And we shared a lot of our stories. And today we want to continue to explore those themes. And the title of this episode is Nobody Joins a Cult. And we're exploring the idea that nobody willingly signs up to be in an abusive environment. But as we look back on what brought us into cults, I think our listeners will discover along with us that sometimes just wanting to belong and be a part of a community can have unintended negative consequences. And so I know that I've got lots of stories about belonging to the United Pentecostal Church and how I ended up there. But Allie, let's begin with you. What do you think brought you into the high control groups that you were involved with?
Well, you know, I think that this idea of nobody joins a cult, like I have to lead with that, because nobody just says like I'm gonna jump into something that is abusive, that is controlling, that's harmful, that's all these different things. It's like nobody willingly does that, right? And so that actually comes from a scene in The Vow, which is probably it's one of the better cult documentaries that's ever been made, in my opinion, and I've watched a lot of them. But there's this guy named Mark Vicente, and there's a moment in the documentary where he kind of because he's coming to all these realizations about his cult and about his leader and all this other type of stuff, and he just has this moment where he snaps, and he's just like, nobody joins a cult. People join a good thing. Like, nobody joins a cult. And that was something for me that was pivotal kind of in my own journey of recovering from being part of high control groups, being part of cults, being part of an abusive church that I don't think technically qualifies as a cult at this point, but definitely was abusive. That really just spoke to my journey that like I wasn't out here like, oh, hey, I'm going to, you know, join the United Pentecostal Church, for example, because, you know, I want to wear a skirt every day of my life. In fact, like I, you know, hated wearing skirts. I hated wearing dresses. Like I did not like it. I did not like wearing dresses before that. I'm a bit of a tomboy. Mm-hmm. So like I wasn't joining these high control groups because I was like, oh yeah, this looks like fun. Like it was because there was an idea.
Yeah.
And we talked about this like in the last episode, but there was this big idea that these groups, or even more specifically, these individual churches, these individual ministries that they were promoting. So I've been in a couple of high control groups, and it kind of is weird. Like, it's weird to admit that. Like, I'm not the person that joins cults, but then it's like kind of like, but like, are you though? like, really, are you? Mm-hmm. But I remember joining the church that I was in, that was part of the UPC, because like the short part of the story is simply because, you know, I went there. I liked the pastor. The pastor was young. He was charismatic. And, you know, he talked a lot about wanting the church to make an impact in our community.
Right.
The church's answer was, well, we just need to bring people here and get them baptized in Jesus' name and get them filled with the Holy Ghost. So get them to where, you know, they're speaking in tongues and whatnot. And then that's going to solve the problems. And so, you know, of course, I was 19 years old. So it was like, oh, you know, yo, that seems like that sounds good, right? Like, I mean, you know, you're 19, you think you're a teenager, you think you can, like, you know, take on the world or whatever. And it was a very simplistic solution, but at that point it was just like, oh, okay, that makes sense. And then I think about, you know, getting involved with The Wall, which was another group that I was
right.
part of at the same time, that was actually part of Truth, which was the UPC church that I was part of. That the whole big idea of that group was, again, like, we want to see people impacted by Jesus. But even more specifically, you know, we kind of think that, like, churches, you know, people are just kind of coming, and they're social clubs and they're country clubs. And what would it look like for there to be supernatural things happening in the church? So what would it be like for people to be healed? What would it be like for people to be operating in the various spiritual gifts that you see happening in the New Testament, including things like prophecy and speaking in tongues and healing, gifts of healing, gifts of faith, gifts of discernment, words of knowledge, those types of things? What would it look like to see those things happen in the church? And so our solution is to pray. And so we're going to pray, and we're going to pray for quote unquote revival to come to these churches. And we're going to pray for all these different things. And we're also going to learn how to move in our own supernatural giftings or whatever, as you were. So it's, again, big idea. Like, this is something that I need in my life. This is something that I need in my spiritual walk. And then getting involved with The Furnace, it was kind of the same type of thing. Like, you know, where I had grown disenchanted kind of with the way that quote unquote traditional church was. Prayer was really a focus of mine. So I wanted to be part of this thing where, you know, we're gonna pray for 18 hours a day, 5 days a week. We're trying to be, you know, 24/7 prayer. That was the draw to me for IHOP, for the International House of Prayer in Kansas City. I was never on staff there, but The Furnace and IHOP KC actually worked pretty closely together, and a lot of the leaders from IHOP KC would come out to The Furnace and would teach and would encourage our staff and would do all sorts of things. I attended, because since I lived, the Furnace was in Virginia, but I lived in Missouri, which was close to where IHOP was, you know, Kansas City, which is in Missouri, by the way,
right.
let me say that, because I just want to fight people whenever I want to fight folks or they're like, oh, yeah, Kansas. No, Kansas City is in Missouri. Thank you. Anyway, but, you know, I would drive like 3 hours up there, and I would go, you know, any chance that I got to go and to sit in their 24-hour prayer room. I would go to conferences. I would listen to the prayer room they had like an audio stream of it, like, so like in the early days of streaming, like I would listen to the audio stream of the prayer room. You know, I'm just doing all this stuff, imbibing all this teaching and whatever, because these people were saying, you know, you have Mike Bickle saying, I'm going to change the expression and under like that God's going to use this ministry to change the expression and understanding of Christianity in a generation. And so whenever you're 22, 23 years old, somebody saying that is like, yeah, that's right.
Exactly.
We need the expression and understanding of Christianity changed. Yeah, that like, sign me up for that. And so that's how I ended up in some of these places was because of the good idea. Now, what happened after that is a different story. But nobody, like I said, you know, nobody just joins this. Like, nobody joins this to say, like, oh, hey, you know, we want people to be abusive toward me.
Right. And, you know, something that stands out to me when you were sharing your experience is that whether it was with the United Pentecostal Church or these other groups that you got involved in, the emphasis was transactional rather than relational. And what I mean by that is that the leaders of these particular groups saw you and me and other people that joined the movement not as an end in and of themselves, but as a means to an end. And we that joined these particular groups began to see ourselves that way, and it also reflected our view of God. So we would pray and we would fast, or we would say that we're going to give because we want to change Christianity and be a part of a generational movement that changes the face of Christianity. And so it moves away from the relational aspect that people are valuable in and of themselves because they are created in the image of God, and it moves them to a place where they are currency to be used and to be exploited for the desires of the leadership and the goals of the leadership of those particular movements to be achieved and to achieve some sort of notoriety or spiritual influence or historical impact as they see it. And unfortunately, people in these parts of the world that engage in these kinds of groups, and certainly this was my experience in the UPC, tend to see God as a transactional relationship. So I remember, you know, there were sayings among us like, pray until something happens, or, you know, if you'll just fast for 3 days, if you'll go on this extended fast, then you'll see miracles and signs and wonders. So God was reduced in that experience to a vending machine where we put in the right currency of prayer and fasting and sacrifice and giving with the expectation that God was going to reward our exceptional group based upon our works and our sacrifice. And this kind of philosophy just perpetuated itself. And so it also set up a system where if people left, then there was no engagement. There was no lament over the end of a relationship because we just concluded, well, they were never with us to begin with. They're reprobate. They're not part of our movement. And so we washed our hands of them and we walked away and had no further contact with them. So if you're wondering if you're part of a cult, pay attention to how they treat you and what the expectations of you are, and how do they treat people that leave, and how do they expect you to interact with those that leave, and how do they talk about God and your relationship with Him? So I just thought it was very interesting how you talked about your relationship with those particular groups and how in so many instances they were transactional.
Oh my gosh, there's so much that you said in that, Scott, that I think is really, really important. And so there's two things that I want to bring out of that. First of all is like the imagery that you talked about using the vending machine. In the prayer movement, we actually had like biblical imagery that we used for that. So I want to come back to that. But then the other thing that you said was about relationships and how relationships sometimes will just end. And something that I used to say is that, like, it seemed like whenever people left, whether, you know, it was the UPC, whether it was the house of prayer or whatever, but there was always this thing of like we don't have object permanence for people once they leave.
Yeah.
Oftentimes we have a scenario where people leave and then it's not just like, oh, they're not with us, but it's just like people would almost just forget that these people exist. And I would even say better than that, because I mean, you know, you might be like, well, but wait a minute, you have relationships and stuff within the church, and that is true. But oftentimes, like, leaders would just, you know, forget that you had left. Like, I remember there was a point when I had actually gone back to visit the church that I was part of. In my book, I call it Living Stones. I won't name it because it still exists, so I won't name it now. But the original iteration of it was Truth, and then Truth this and that, and then it morphed. It whenever we left the UPC, a couple years after we left the UPC, the name of the church changed. And so in my book, I Won't Shut Up, which I should probably talk about more, but I won't
yes.
here.
I call.
Oh, thank you. I call this church Living Stones. Well. There were a couple of times after we had moved to Virginia that after my husband and I had moved to Virginia that we would actually, you know, go back and visit and would visit, you know, we'd go and see our friends and stuff. And so then, of course, if we want to see everybody who we had been friends with, you know, for almost a decade, the place to see everybody was church, right? And so I remember we had probably been gone I don't even think it had even been a full year. I don't think it was a full year. And I came back and I said hi to the pastor, whatever, you know, he acted like he was happy to see us. And he was like, oh yeah, y'all have been gone for like, what, 3 years now? And I'm like, it's even like gone for like, you know, 3 years, 5 years, something like that. And I'm just like, we were gone. It maybe had been a year.
Wow.
Possibly 2 years, but I don't even think it had even been a year. If it was 2 years, 3 years would have been a guess, would have been a good guess, but it was more like, it wasn't even a year. And it was like, oh, whatever. And so again, like that object permanence thing. So that's one thing that I wanted to say. And I think that you're right, that a sign of an unhealthy religious group is when, or any kind of group, I shouldn't even say religious, any kind of group, if you leave that group, you were a significant part of the group, you were a leader, you gave a lot, you were there all the time, you gave of your time, of your resources, of whatever, and then people just kind of treat you like you don't exist, like you lose all of your friends. Like if you leave, it means losing a lot of your friends and a lot of your community, or losing significant parts of it, then that probably is an unhealthy situation to be in, just, you know, FYI. But then the other thing with this whole transactional thing with God, in the house of prayer, we would talk about using like the imagery from the book of Revelation where, you know, there are angels or whatever, elders, I can't remember if it's the angels or the elders, but they're holding bowls that are full of incense, which is the prayers of the saints. And so then, you know, the apostle John or John the Divine sees these bowls being poured out or whatever. And so like, we would take, you know, our little prayer meeting that's going on in Virginia, and then, you know, maybe the prayer meeting that's also happening going 24/7 in Kansas City, and then, you know, all the other little houses of prayer across the nation. Our iconography of that was, you know, well, we're praying, and as we're praying, God is filling up the bowls, and he's going to pour out the incense. So he's going to, you know, he's going to pour out his judgments, which I'm just going to be real. Like, I never agreed with that part of the theology that God was going to like judge people. Cause I believe that, you know, the Bible says that mercy triumphs over judgment. And so it's not, I mean, I, like, you know, because I am a Black woman who lives in these United States and has seen a lot of historic and personal tragedy, yes, I believe that God is going to judge some certain people, but the people that he judging ain't going to be the people that people think that he's judging. So, like, you know, God's not going to be pouring out. Like, I don't think that God is going to be pouring out his judgment on queer people, period. I don't think that God is going to be pouring out his judgment on people of different religions, period. But I do think that God is going to be pouring out judgment. And I don't know what that looks like. I'm not saying, you know, that he's going to kill people. I'm just saying because I believe in God. I think that, you know, God is not too pleased with white supremacy.
Amen.
And that at some point,
yes,
something's going to happen.
Agreed.
But you know, we would sit and we would pray just some of these like just weird people would pray just something like these really just like weird kind of prayers about God, you know, pouring out his judgments and his judgments being righteous and singing songs about this because the theology was there of, you know, somehow, you know, there's all this stuff that's going on in the world, but God is paying attention to the things that we're singing and the things that we're praying in this prayer meeting. And it was purely transactional.
Yeah.
I shouldn't say purely, but a very large amount of it was we're begging God to change something, or we're begging God to do something. We're begging God to fill these bowls of incense that he can then, you know, pour out in whatever that looks like. So if that's judgment, if that's revival, if that's whatever it is, if that's the person that people didn't like who was seemed to be winning the presidential election, which I never agreed with those prayers. But anyway, right. There's this transactionality that happens, and we've talked a lot about God and a lot about how we're being transactional with God, but in reality, a lot of the transactionality, I don't know if that's the word, but I made it up. If it ain't, it works. But a lot of that was God was sort of the front or the foil for it. But a lot of it was how people interacted with people. Mm-hmm. And I will say that, you know, my former UPC church, I remember, you know, it starting out very much, like whenever I was there, whenever I first started going there, it was very much, you know, community oriented, like, you know, we're like church family, blah, 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 blah.
Right.
But there was a point when stuff, like, I remember the point when things became more about the vision of the person, mm-hmm. than the community. I remember that point. Whenever I say community, I mean the church community.
Right.
But it was this being in service to the idea. And this was especially true in the prayer movement, where we burned through so many people. IHOP burns through so many people. They claim something like having had, like, over the past 25 years or so, having something like 20,000 staff. That is not a flex, because their average, there was a point when they had a bit more than this, but their average, you know, was 300-400 people, maybe 500 people on staff at a time. And that's students and staff. And over 25 years, you've burnt, and then the community is maybe 2,000 people. So basically, like, you've retained like 10% of the 20,000 over 25 years. And this is something that you're saying people are like the idea is, like, you're joining this movement and you're putting years into this movement. That's not a, like 20,000 people, that's not a flex. Like, that's literally, you know, you're treating people like their bodies are logs, and their bodies are pieces of coal, and you're throwing it into the fire to fuel the machine. But it's transactional God, or transactional, you know, transactional relationship with the divine, if we're talking religious cults. But it's also labor exploitation at mm-hmm. the end of the day. That's what it is.
Absolutely. And when you said that, I thought of something that famously Mark Driscoll, who was a pastor of Mars Hill Church in Seattle. He's now pastoring the Trinity Church in Phoenix, Arizona, and very cultic in his personality persona. And he famously said of his vision and his persona that he was driving the bus, and that if you look behind the bus, you'll find all kinds of bodies that have been run over. So he was bragging about the body count that his mm-hmm. ministry left in the wake. And so when you talk about the idea of controlling what people should wear, because the image and the persona of the pastor and of the leadership and of the image that they want to curate and present to the world becomes more important than the people involved, then most likely you are dealing with a high control group and with cultic aspirations, because they want to be seen as exceptional. They want to be seen as someone who is, as you mentioned with Mike Bickle, changing the generational face of Christianity. And you mentioned the transactional aspect of the prayer room and all of that. And what those kinds of prayers produce, and collectively, we don't think about this, but collectively, they obviously, they're not working with God. So I don't believe that we have any ability to twist the arm of God to make him do something that he doesn't intend to do. But what it does to people is dangerous, because collectively, it over time constructs their perspective of other people. If you think about what is happening in the Middle East, in Israel and Gaza right now, how many Christians, and especially those in high control type groups, are praying actively for the destruction of Gaza, for the Palestinians, for those children that are being orphaned, that are being killed, that are being maimed by Israel. And no matter how you feel about that conflict, I think everyone who is ethical should agree that little children should not be killed. But when you talk to people in these high control groups, it's the attitude is, well, Israel can do no harm and can do no wrong because they're God's chosen people. And so what you have cultivated by these kinds of prayers is almost a reverse of anti-Semitism, where it says, no matter what atrocity national Israel may commit, we're going to say, we're going to embrace it. Or the converse is true as well. When we look at attacks by Hamas and other terrorist groups, Christians that are part of these high control groups will often applaud and say, yes, finally, you know, we're seeing trouble, we're seeing war, because in their mind, it accelerates the return of Jesus Christ, because they've been conditioned to believe all of these things that are proclaimed by their high control groups. Ali, you've said a lot there, and we're going to follow up on that, and I'm going to share some of my experiences on why I ended up in a cult on the other side of a short break. So stay with us. You're listening to High Control. Welcome back to the High Control Podcast. My name is Scott Lloyd, along with my friend Ali Henney. And today we're exploring some of the reasons why we ended up in a cult. And Ali, you shared some of your experiences. And unlike you, who joined a cult rather late in life, I was sort of born into it. So my family was a part of the United Pentecostal Church when I was born. In 1971, my dad did not attend, but my paternal grandmother was an original member of the small rural Pentecostal United Pentecostal Church that we attended in Blytheville, Arkansas, just right below the Boot Hill of Missouri, about an hour north of Memphis, and about 3 hours south of St. Louis. So that was the geographical context of the place that I was born, the time, and the church was a huge influence over every aspect of our lives. The last time we were together, we talked about the fact that the United Pentecostal Church, and you touched on it as well, had an emphasis on how people dressed and how people behaved, especially when it came to the bodies of women and what they did with their hair and what they wore. And the same thing with men. There were prohibitions against facial hair, and we couldn't wear shorts. And depending upon the region or the pastor, you couldn't wear short sleeves. And prohibitions against jewelry and other aspects as well. So it was very high control. And I remember those formative moments in my life. So as a very young person, even as a toddler, I remember seeing the worship services and the enthusiasm and the emotionalism, and it was all tied often to these apocalyptic themes from the book of Revelation, that Jesus was coming at any moment, and if we sinned in thought or deed, we could be left behind, and then we would experience all of the atrocities that would be poured out upon the world, that would be brought by the Antichrist. So for a little kid living in this kind of atmosphere, it produced a lot of anxiety. It produced a lot of fear. And I remember even on Wednesday night, sometimes they would turn the service over to the youth group, and the youth group would model and amp up emotion of these particular themes. And they produced a skit, which was a short play. And I remember as a toddler, I was sitting there around adults, and I was watching this take place on the platform. And they had a couple people standing in a radio booth, pretending, play acting that they were doing a broadcast. And that broadcast was suddenly interrupted by a news bulletin that people all over the world were disappearing. And then they cut off all of the lights in that small auditorium we were a part of. Somebody blew a trumpet rather badly, and then the lights come back on. And I'm this little kid, this toddler, right? And I'm looking to my left and right, and there were adults that were sitting beside me before that trumpet blew that are now gone. They slipped out of the auditorium when they turned out all the lights. Now, can you imagine what I was feeling in that moment, the trauma and the anxiety that it produced? So from that moment forward, every time I came home and my parents weren't where they were supposed to be, or my siblings weren't where they were supposed to be, I can laugh about it now because there are comical aspects about it. But at the time, it was very traumatic and anxiety ridden. And to this day, there are moments where I catch myself where I see that other people are in pressure situations and they seem to be functioning quite well, whereas inside I'm having all of this anxiety. And sometimes I wonder, where does that come from? This social anxiety, this fear of not being in control. And I think it had a lot to do with those formative experiences. So when we ask the question about who joins a cult and why, I think a lot of times we miss the unintended consequences of children being brought up in these high control situations. And there's the axiom that geography is destiny was absolutely true in my case. Geography and family of origin, the place that I was born, the time that I was born, had a lot to do with what I believed and why I believed it through most of my life, because it was informed by this cultic religion in the United Pentecostal Church that was delivered to me in a very emotional and traumatic way.
Man, that's wild. And I have friends who grew up in the UPC. I have become acquainted with, I have some friends who grew up at IHOP, who were part of IHOP's founding. So like, you know, their parents joined IHOP and they were, you know, infants or toddlers or very young, very young people, which in that community, I think is a little bit of an anomaly. Like there are kind of children of IHOP, but it's not like the vast majority of people who are, the vast majority of people who are at IHOP are there because they came as young adults, because IHOP targets young adults. It targets those 18 to 25 year olds. Mike Bickle is like really good at that. He was especially very good about that in the late 90s and in the 2000s, whenever I was part of it, whenever I was part of the movement. And I think that those experiences are experiences that are oftentimes overlooked whenever we talk about cultic groups, because you have the people who joined. And like I said, you know, nobody joins a cult, right? But then you also, that idea, that maxim of nobody joins a cult is true even for people who are children, who are born into these types of cultic groups that they also did not join. They were just part of it. And something that a difference, I guess, in our stories is that I did not grow up in a cult. I did not grow up in the churches that I was part of. There were things that were unhealthy about them, but there weren't necessarily, I mean, there's things that are unhealthy, you know, about, you know, any group of people. It has a group of people can have toxicity and stuff that comes out. But my church experience, I feel like, was fairly run-of-the-mill. The church that I, the Pentecostal church that I grew up in, we believed in Jesus' name baptism. You know, we believed in speaking in tongues. We believed some of those same core doctrines. You know, there was kind of an expectation that, you know, women would wear skirts to church, but I literally do not ever remember ever being told that to my face. You know, maybe somebody might have said something to my mom here or there, or my mom maybe kind of peeped game and was like, oh yeah, you shouldn't wear pants to church. I did wear pants to church a couple of times, but it wasn't a thing. We weren't out here like trying to convert people like that. Like, yeah, you know, my mom and stepdad would go and like they would do quote unquote evangelism, which meant that they would go to like the supermarket. There was like a supermarket in town, and they would go and they would stand there and like, you know, hand out like flyers and stuff, inviting people to come to church or whatever. But it was not like as hardcore as UPC. And at least like, again, the church that I was involved in the region that I was involved in, I never had any of those culty type experiences. I mean, it just felt very run of the mill church to me. And like my experiences were very similar to some of my peers' experiences and stuff in their small rural churches or whatever. And so it wasn't until I got to college and then young adulthood where I was part of some of these groups. And so I say all of that then to say, you know, that for myself, I didn't have certain things that was like placing phobias. I think that's what Stephen Hassan calls them in the book Combating Cult Mind Control. He talks about how high control groups will instill phobias in their members. And so there are things that like, you might be like, phobias, like you mean that like you're gonna give people arachnophobia or like what are you doing? It's not necessarily that type of thing. It's more like some of the things and you kind of hit on this earlier whenever you were talking, Scott, but this idea that like if you leave the group, then like, oh, well, you weren't really part of the group. Well, you weren't really saved. Well, you weren't really this and that. Well, you know, you leave the group and you know, your woman that leaves, that gets tired of all the pressure, she leaves, she cuts her hair, she starts wearing pants, she starts wearing nail polish and jewelry. Oh, well, she just wanted to do that anyway. She wasn't really saved. And so like, I didn't have those phobias. And so, and I think that there's something about about those phobias, being implanted in you from a young age, that it's part of your development. It's part of your development. And so I think that it's harder to shake because it's part of like your early development, it's part of your early world. And so it's harder to shake that, where, you know, for someone like me who was a young adult, my brain still wasn't fully formed yet. You know, I was 19 years old, 19 and 20 and, you know, 22, 23 years old, whenever I was connecting with some of these groups. And so my brain wasn't fully formed yet either. I was still in adolescence, but it had such a different effect on me. And I think that is something that is very important to note with cult members, with those of us who've been through this, that you have the people who it's a formative part of their experience. But even as somebody who joined some of these groups later in life, there have been times where I've been like, oh my goodness, like, am I leaving? Like, one of the things, I worship at an Episcopal church now. And it was the direction I felt like I needed to go. But I remember kind of having some of these moments of, what am I raising my kids in? Like, if I'm raising my kids, you know, in like what if I'm doing something wrong? Because that was a phobia that was placed in us in leaving, you know, the prayer movement, and leaving it wasn't so much UPC baggage for me as much it was prayer movement baggage of, you know, wanting my kids to know God and to grow up, you know, being solid in their faith and stuff for God. And there's a lot more that I could say about that, and a lot more, you know, mindsets and everything. There's a lot more, you know, that I could say about that and about how my mindset has changed. But that was a very real thing. And I had to kind of say, you know, I had to kind of like really reason with myself and talk myself through that, because, you know, the phobias are real.
Yeah. And I think you touched on a lot there, but especially this idea of how culture forms us and conditions us to look at the world and to look at one another and to look at our families from a particular perspective. And if you listen closely to apologists, those that defend the position of some of these groups, in my context, the United Pentecostal Church, and even when I was a part of the UPC, I bought into this kind of rhetoric that said, well, when it comes to the dress codes and when it comes to the prohibitions that we practice, what we commonly refer to as holiness standards, we would say things like to one another, and certainly to those that were investigating our group, we would say things, well, we don't demand this kind of behavior from anyone. These aren't rules that are enforced in our church. But these are lifestyles that we choose to embrace because we want to draw closer to God. And these are personal convictions. These are personal consecrations. And we believe that they help us gain spiritual power or influence or strength or maturity in some way. But we're not expecting anyone, especially new converts, to conform. But in group dynamics, if you're part of a group and you see everyone that is speaking to you, everyone that is on the platform singing the songs, they have a distinctive look. They're all dressing the same way. They're all acting the same way. And they're all using the same language. If you buy in to the philosophy of the group, then over time, and certainly in a short amount of time, you're going to begin to mirror the dress codes, the behavior, the language that is used by the group. And that is a function of culture. So when apostolic groups and the United Pentecostal Church and other cults make this claim, well, we're not forcing anybody to do this, they're being a little deceitful because they're not acknowledging how group dynamics work, especially within a controlled group, a high control group. And think about this. You know, we were going to church at least three times a week. We were Sunday morning, Sunday night, and Wednesday night. And then there were other nights that were designated for prayer times or for volunteer time.
Meeting.
Absolutely. Yep. So a lot of our time throughout the week was tied up within these groups. And that was on purpose because as these groups control your time, they influence your behavior because what you see modeled, you begin to adopt as your own behavior. And that's the function of culture. And that's exactly what you were talking about, how we were being conditioned to believe, to behave a certain way in a very short amount of time. And that's a function of all of these high control groups.
You know, I was amen and mm-hmm, because the whole thing about, like, you know, the maturity and this and that with abiding by the holiness standards, that was something that was attractive to me as a 19-year-old who I had grown up in a home that was God-fearing. You know, my mom, my grandmother were both God-fearing women. We attended church. We were kind of in and out of the little Baptist church in my hometown because there were, you know, various kind of like little scandals and stuff that would happen. We would go and then something would happen and then we would stop going and then, you know, there'd be a new pastor or something like that and we would go. So we were kind of in and out. But my family was very much God-fearing. And, you know, I knew about Jesus. I knew the Bible. It was I had a faith that was my own in a lot of ways, but then as a teenager, it was when I started to get serious about my faith, and particularly whenever I was a senior in high school. That's a whole other story that I won't go into. But whenever I was a senior in high school, I really started to become serious about my faith and really wanted to explore Christianity and explore spirituality and stuff for myself. And so as I encountered my church, my UPC church, one of the things I knew going into it, and kind of one of the hesitancies that I had about going, because I'm the type of person that I don't go to no kind of church, no kind of anything, without looking at it on the internet first and reading about it. And so I spent a lot of my senior year of high school actually reading about different denominations and reading about different churches and stuff. And so I knew what the distinctives of the United Pentecostal Church was. And the reason why I had selected the church that I did was because I did like see a few women there wearing pants. And so I was like, oh, okay. And I saw men with beards. And so I was like, oh, okay. Like, so this isn't like this, they're not like the other United Pentecostal churches. But what I didn't realize, I wasn't there, you know, for a while until I realized that, like, you know, the women who were wearing pants were second-class citizens in the church, effectively. So, like, they weren't demanding that they wear pants, but then it was put to me because I could play the drums a little bit, and they needed a drummer on Wednesday nights in the adult service. And so the pastor did say, he was like, you know, because he was kind of facing a crisis himself with some of these things. So he did say to me, you know, I don't care what you do outside of church, but you've got to wear you got to wear a skirt whenever you're on the platform. Now, if looking back, I wish that I would have just taken him up on that and would have just kept on wearing my pants, doing what I was doing, and then just kind of let that force the issue within the church. But then I'm having conversations with other people who are like, oh yeah, well, you know, in order to be on the platform, like, you know, I'm hearing about people like not being able to vote at business meetings because somebody saw them wearing, you know, pants, or at the grocery store or whatever. So I'm like, okay, well, if I'm going to be in this, then I need to be like in, like, you know, for me, it was like a measure of like, I don't want people to think that I'm a hypocrite, that like, if they see me outside of church, like I'm not doing what everybody else is doing. So I'm going to do this. But it kind of was like a little bit of a bait and switch,
yes.
But it was also really just like, I think it was like extraordinarily disingenuous, because it's like, that's what I feel like that some of the things, and I mean, and I said them too, is like, you tell yourself stuff so you feel better about doing it. Because here I am, you know, in college, you know, I was skinny. Not that being skinny is everything. I'm fat now, and I like being fat. I try to be body positive. But I think about, you know, like I was a size 8, you know, size 8, size 10. I'm tall. It was my youth is maybe what I'm lamenting here more than you know what was on the scale. But you know, I was in my youth. I was cute. You know, I was whatever, and I participated in this thing. And my mother-in-law is really good about taking pictures. She would always, you know, have her camera around, and now she does with her phone. And so whenever I go to my in-law's house, their screensaver is just all the digitized pictures that they have. So they have scans of pictures of my husband and his siblings from whenever they were kids. It's uploads from my mother-in-law's digital cameras and everything over the years. And I always look at myself really hard whenever those pictures come up from that 5 year, what would have been like a 5 year period thereabouts. And I look at her, and I'm just like, you know, I don't maybe have like the usual kind of, oh my God, what were you wearing in college? That like what a lot of people would be like. But I think about like the styles and stuff, and I'm just like, I participated in the styles that I could participate in. So it's like, I could relate because like I saw my peers wearing things, but it's like some of the styles, like, you know, you kind of participate in, but you can't really. And I don't know. I just look back at that, and I'm just like, yeah, you know, that definitely, if I had to walk like that part of the journey, I would have maybe traversed that part of the journey differently. And would have really challenged myself a bit more. But anyway, you know, you tell yourself things. And I think that whenever you're in a high control group, there are things that you tell yourself, because if you really start to pull at the thread of the deception, of the lies, of the hype, of all those other types of things, if you really start to pull at those threads, mm-hmm. Then sometimes you might find something that you don't like. And the last thing that I'll say about this, and then I'll hush up, because I know we gotta wrap up here. But there was also, and I think particularly I saw it with the youth, there was like a propagandization of, again, I'm just making up words, of following the holiness standards.
Yeah.
And so I don't know, you might have been out by this point, but I remember back in like, it would have been 2005, or 2006, excuse me, because it was my first youth convention. There was this group, I'm remembering the name of the group. The name of the group was Fallen Chains. And they had this song. It was like the guys in the group, in the band, it was a 3-piece band. I think they were from Wisconsin or something like that. They were maybe like, you know, around 25 years old. And they sang this song about a girl in a jean skirt. And like, and it's like, you know, I thank God for the girl with the jean skirt, with the jean skirt on. And so, and the song is like going, like the song is basically like elucidating what the model Pentecostal girl looks like. And of course, you know, she had like long flowing hair or whatever. And I'm sitting here, you know, African-American, like, okay, my hair don't do like that. But okay. And people, like, they sold shirts that was like, I'm the girl in the jean shirt, in the jean skirt. And girls would wear that shirt, and you would see, like, because I remember it was pink with blue writing, and you would see girls wearing this because it validated them, because, you know, they were the girl at their public school who always wore a jean skirt, who always, because you don't have very many options, because skirts always look dressed up. So the way that we kind of felt dressed down was to wear jean skirts. And and so it was just, there was so much like propaganda around that.
Right.
I didn't fully adopt it into my heart as like, this is exactly what I'm doing to please God. That spell got broken. That was what got me in, but that spell got broken pretty quickly. As I started to like read the Bible more and be like, actually that doesn't seem right. But it was the allure of being in leadership, of being able to, because I want to be part of the community. Like, I want to be part of the church community, but I can't do that if I'm wearing pants. Mm-hmm. So like, you know, I can't do music, and music was like something that I wanted to do in the church at that point. I couldn't do that if I was wearing pants. I couldn't lead the youth group if I was wearing pants. So a lot of it was kind of acquiescing to these holiness standards, because I guess, like, I mean, if we're going to get real, you know, my therapy session here, if we're going to get real deep with it, some of it was that, like, I mean, it's like, I'm a Black woman from rural Missouri. I don't have a name. You know, I didn't have a name then. I mean, we have a little bit of one now, but I didn't have a name then. You know, I didn't know anybody. It was nobody from nowhere. And so it was like, but I felt a call to ministry, and for whatever reason, I didn't see enough in myself or see enough in anything to be like, well, I could just, you know, go to like any church, and if I have this call, I could go anywhere and find a way to excel and get in where I fit in. But that was just, that was what was there. And those people were what was there. That abusive pastor was who was there and who spoke something into me. And because maybe I didn't necessarily see enough in myself, and it was good enough for people to see something in me, that I was just sort of like, okay, hey, I'm going to, you know, sign up for all this and do all this. And I don't want that to sound like I'm blaming myself, because I'm absolutely not blaming myself, because cults screw with your brain. And that's exactly what happened to me.
Yeah, and you touched on something that I think is very important for our listeners, especially in the context of what we're talking about today, about who joins a cult and why. You did research. You looked at the internet. You're obviously a highly intelligent person. So a lot of times we have the misnomer that cults prey on vulnerable populations, people that aren't that intelligent. And certainly that is part of their modus operandi. But it doesn't exclude intelligent people that do their research. And if you think about what you just described from your childhood forward, you were conditioned to find these groups because you had already had formative experiences that opened you up to their practices. What you saw modeled in the churches as a child coming up. And certainly I did as well. And where my journey led me, You described some of these progressive ideas that were even within these cults that, well, you know, we're going to have conversations about inviting people, and if it's okay for them not to look Pentecostal, and yes, we want to be more progressive and to be more accepting, but what it amounted to was a bait and switch, and here's why. Culture always wins. No matter how someone thinks about their identity or how they think about their group, and in the context of the United Pentecostal Church, I served on staffs, pastoral staffs, where the lead pastor wanted to be more progressive. He understood that the holiness standards that we embraced were not biblical. But I had one experience in a very progressive district and a progressive United Pentecostal Church, and we were having a harvest fest in October, and my wife and I were new to the church, and I was doing some preaching and assisting and things of that nature. And we saw that women outside of the church always wore pants. And so we thought, well, great, this is wonderful, this is progressive. So to the harvest fest, my wife wore pants, and shortly after that following week, the pastor called me in and said, hey, this is not a big deal. I don't want to debate with you about this. I know there's no biblical justification, but just do me a favor. And when your wife is on campus, on the campus of the church, wear a skirt, wear a dress. And the problem was that he got flack from some of the older members, the culture that was so ingrained that this is what leadership looks like. You know, and he just decided that battle wasn't worth the fight. And from a leadership perspective, I understand that, because if you're wanting to, and here's what culture does, it enforces the status quo. And if you are a leader and you're wanting to make incremental changes over time, then you have to pick your battles. But what ends up happening is that your livelihood, some of these leaders, even if they're being honest about what they believe and about what they teach, their livelihood is chained to the status quo being upheld. Because if they upset enough people, then their salary goes out the door. You touched on so much there that is so important for all of us to understand. And I think the bottom line as we wrap up this episode is that anybody is susceptible to these kinds of high control groups. And what you've got to do is you've got to be proactive in educating yourself, but also evaluating your own experiences and your own bias and your own blind spots, and understanding that this is about culture, it's about status quo, it's about everything that, where we live, how we talk, our geography, our family of origin, everything about us and our experiences brings us to the moments where we choose how we're going to live our life and where we are going to have community. And at some point, we've got to say, you know what? I have to free myself from all of that so then I can choose intelligently the group that I want to identify with and who I want to be with and how I want to do life. And any group or any culture that robs you of your agency and your ability to choose, that is a cult. It is, at the very least, a high control group, and you have to work to maintain that perspective that I'm going to stay free. I'll give you the last word on this idea.
Well, you said a mouthful. I don't even know if there's really much that I can add to that. Other than, you know, I really hope that this show helps you as a listener to unravel some of these things for yourself. You know, Scott and I, we're talking about our experiences. We're talking, you know, trying to not be extraordinarily insider ball, but I think that it helps to see some of these things, to talk about, you know, some of these specific experiences that maybe you're listening and you're like, hey, my cultic group was like that. And even if it's not like, again, you know, this is, we're talking religion because that's both of our wheelhouses. Whenever we think about cults, a lot of cults that tends to be, it tends to be religious groups. But a lot of these things you could apply to, you know, to MLMs. You could apply to leadership cults, to a corporate cult, I think what they call them, to political cults.
Right.
It's not just exclusive to religion. And so, you know, there's more to be said about cult stigma. And I hope that we're able to get into that a little bit more in future episodes. But, yeah, there's not anything wrong with you because you were in a high control.
Right.
And that's something, there's not something fundamentally wrong with you. And that's something that I am still working on, even in myself, that these groups take advantage of people. Their MO is to exploit people. And there can be good things that can come from our involvement in terms of there might be skills or resources or whatever things that we learn that we can make into positives. There's relationships that we have with people. Sometimes if you are able to actually, you know, forge strong friendships or relationships, you know, some people meet their spouse while they're in a cult. That wasn't my experience, but I know that some people, that's their experience, and right. you have to walk through that. And so, so all that to say that, I hope that this episode, that it benefits you, and that, you find your story in this, and that it helps you recover, or it helps you, maybe you play this episode for a friend or a relative or loved one or something like that, and that it helps them to get free.
Absolutely. And just to echo what Ali is saying, if the experiences that we're sharing, if the information that we're sharing is a benefit to you, please like and subscribe to our podcast and share this episode and other episodes with friends and family, because I think all of us can benefit from evaluating our lives, reflecting on our experiences, and as Ali has expressed, understanding that all of our experiences add up to the person that we are today, the good, the bad, and the ugly. And I hope that all of us can benefit from the information that we're sharing. This has been the High Control Podcast. I'm your host for this episode, Scott Lloyd. Thank you to my friend, Ali Henney, and we'll see you next time.
You've been listening to High Control. Don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe to our show. You can catch us on social media at High Control Pod. Check the show notes for resources and how to get in touch. Stay in control, friends.